Good morning, everybody. Welcome to concurrent session one, the rise and fall of inflation indices by Hugh Miller. If you're not here for that, now is your opportunity to leave. I'll just quickly remind everyone, by the way, sorry, my name's Wayne Cannon, Queensland State Actuary's Office, and esteemed colleague of Michael Clacker, who's joined us. Pretty pleased about that. I'll just quickly remind everyone, I dare say you've gone through these sort of things before, but if you could ask any questions, we'd like to do the questions at the end, if you wouldn't mind, so that Hugh's allowing plenty of time for questions. So if you could get into the mic, it's very important, especially for those who are going to be watching these sessions from on the web, etc. And if you could keep your questions to the end, I think I said that. Yep. And I think we'll get going with no further ado. So let me just quickly give you an intro for Hugh. Hugh Miller is a left-handed actuary at Taylor Fry, where he has worked for the past 10 years. During that time, he has been involved in a wide variety of projects across general insurance. He has a PhD in statistics and a particular interest in improved techniques for modelling in pricing and reserving work. He's also been applying these skills more broadly, most recently in customer loyalty and social sector welfare modelling. It's great to see that he's overcome those sinistral difficulties and is able to present to us today. So over to you, Hugh, the rise and fall of inflation indices.
Thank you very much, Wayne. And thank you all for coming. So I chose possibly the most boring topic, but somewhat embarrassingly, it's the second time that I've presented on this topic as well. So I really do love boring things like inflation indices. So if you're looking for a detailed and insightful look about how GI companies should be using inflation indices and understanding inflation risk, you're going to be disappointed today, partly because those ideas have already been done better by other people. So there's a list of a few papers there. So John de Raven's paper, I think inflation risk in general insurance is quite good for understanding how a general insurance company might approach the idea of inflation and risk. So today's talk is more about just some curiosity-driven questions I had, and I basically wanted an excuse to trawl the ABS website for a few days and really understand some of the nuts and bolts of inflation, and I had a few questions that I wanted to address as well. So there is a paper that goes with this presentation as well, so if you are interested in some of the finer detail, I think it's probably explained in that paper, and hopefully with some semblance of structure and order, which might be different to today's talk. So what I'm going to do today is talk through seven hypotheses that I had about inflation indices. And I'm going to talk mainly about the two biggest ones, I think, used in Australia, so the Consumer Price Index, CPI, and AWE, Australian Weekly Earnings. So seven hypotheses I had about them and testing whether that's true or not, and hopefully you find some of this stuff to some extent interesting, almost as much as me. So the first hypothesis is that using CPI blindly as an indexing function is a mistake. And so the rationale here is that, like all statistical constructs, the CPI in some ways is a very artificial metric. So it has lots of assumptions and lots of ways that it gets put together. And the more you study into detail, perhaps the less comfortable you'd be applying it directly to lots of situations. So the conclusion was largely borne out, although the peer reviewer suggested I use slightly less offensive language. So the CPI is quite artificial in how it's constructed, and I think that does put limits on how you should use it. That said, I'm not trying to denigrate it in any way, so it's probably the most robust and best statistic that's produced in Australia, and the ABS is one of the best statistical agencies in the world, and I love them dearly. So it's not that it's a bad statistic, it's just that it's limited in some ways. So to understand that, it's worth reviewing what the CPI is. So most of you will be familiar with this. So the CPI is a basket of good index. So it's supposed to represent a shopping basket of what the average household spends their money on. So they do this by big surveys, and they run these surveys every 6 years or so. So the current weightings are quite out of date. So the current CPI is based on weightings developed in 2009, 2010. So those weightings then basically ascribe different weights to different categories. So 0.34% of the CPI index will be women's footwear, for instance, and then for each category that you can think of that people spend money on, they'll all have a specific weight. Those weights remain fixed, and so that's the basket of goods, and so then you measure the price changes of those baskets over time. That said, there is a little bit of substitution. So generally it's a fixed basket, but when you get that right down to sort of the lowest level, they do allow some price substitution. So if one price of bread goes up a little bit, they sort of assume that some people will move to a different brand of bread. So within that basket of goods, there's a hierarchy of items. So there are 11 categories. So they're the big ticket categories like health and food and clothing and so forth. And within each of them, there's a number of subcategories. So there are 87 subcategories, and each of them is published by the ABS each quarter. Within those, they have defined about 1,000 elementary aggregates. So these are sort of the low-level things like white sandwich bread. And those are the things that sort of all sort of cascade up to construct the CPI index. So the construction of each of those elementary aggregates is quite interesting. So if you think of something like a white sandwich bread, you have to think about, well, what are the different brands of white sandwich bread? Do I include all those artisan breads, those sourdoughs, is that white sandwich? I don't know. You have to decide where that bread is being purchased, because white sandwich bread from a supermarket is quite different from white sandwich bread from a servo in terms of price, if not quality. And then you have to sort of define how you're going to collect those things each quarter. So how frequently you have to do it. So petrol moves a lot, so you have to collect it fairly frequently and so forth. So a lot of work goes into those 1,000 elementary aggregates. And they have fixed weights, and then they sort of get bundled up into a broad CPI measure. So there are field agents who collect those in all the capital cities, those prices, and they collect about 100,000 prices per quarter. So it's supposed to cover most of the spending, consumer-level spending, in the eight capital cities. I'll talk about exclusions in a second. And the other defining feature of the CPI is that it's a quality-adjusted index. So quality in the sense that if you make an adjustment to the product, then you make some allowance for that. So there are obvious ways to do that. So if you shrink your box of cornflakes by 10%, that's equivalent to a 10% price increase. But then it gets a lot harder the more you think about it. So if somebody starts adding more fibre to their white bread, that's a quality increase, I guess. Is that a price decrease? How much of a price decrease does that represent? Similarly, you get sort of weird things happening. So you get big deflation in tech segments, of course. So on a quality adjusted basis, the iPhone has decreased in price massively over time. But of course, the amount of money you pay to Apple has not decreased massively over time to buy an iPhone. So there are lots of complications there. But in theory, it's about this sort of fixed basket of goods. So the most important thing, I think, to know about the CPI, and most people do, is that CPI is actually a mix of different trends. So I've picked out five of the 11 categories there. So there's health, new homes, legal expenses, contents, so like the home furnishings, and the price of new cars. And you can see each of them have quite different trends over 15 years. And not only that, those trends are incredibly consistent. So health has consistently been 5%. So when you think about CPI being 2.5%, you're really thinking about that 2.5% representing an average of different trends. And some things are even negative. So new cars have consistently been below zero in their price inflation on a quality adjusted basis. And other things are very close to zero. A lot of things are close to that 2% target. And then some things are even higher than the Reserve Bank band. So that said, even within subcategories, you get the same effect. So remember, health had a 5.1% increase over the past 15 years on the previous slide. health has four subcategories. And each of those subcategories have their own trends, and again, those trends have been very consistent over 15 years. So if you wonder why you see superimposed inflation when you've got hospital costs, it should be no surprise, because hospital costs have been increasing at 6.7% per year for the past 15 years. And that then is counterbalanced by some other costs like dental, pharmaceutical and appliances, which have had lower price inflation over that time. So CPI is a mix of different trends, and because of that, it is actually worth thinking about what components is in CPI or are in CPI, and what components are relevant to you. So I'll talk a little bit about the exclusions. Sometimes people get a little bit surprised by these. There are some important exclusions from CPI. So the first one is, of course, it excludes all of regional Australia. It's a capital city index, and so to the extent that regional Australia dynamics and prices and changes are different to the cities, you'll see very different things. And that's almost certainly going to be the case, as you can imagine. So regional Australia is probably about a third of the Australian population, so you are capturing most of it in CPI. But certainly not all of it. So the chart there shows the difference between house prices in country Victoria and Melbourne. And as you can imagine, there's sort of a lot of increase in Melbourne house prices relative to country. So the difference has been sort of gone from plus 50% to plus 100% over the last 30 years. Which, of course, creates its own different price dynamics. So that is a big exclusion, and to the extent that you're exposed to prices in regional Australia rather than the city, you might expect to experience different trends. Interestingly, bank interest, so the interest you pay on your mortgage, is excluded from CPI. So I think there's some philosophical argument there, like because that's sort of not the real economy, it's worth excluding it. But it is worth noting that it does actually make the RBA look good as well, because if they increase interest rates to reduce demand and sort of dampen CPI, it would look bad if then everyone's mortgage rates went up and that sort of worked in the opposite direction. So it is interesting, and I mean, mortgage interest is a huge part of the Australian economy and how it works. So I think that's fascinating. Life insurance and super costs. So that's sort of maybe 3% of GDP. So it's a big deal, but it's excluded because it was sort of put in the too hard basket as opposed to the CPI basket. So that every now and again they do review it and decide whether they'll do a better stab at including the cost of life insurance and superannuation management. But to this point it's excluded. Also quite interesting is the purchase of existing properties is excluded from CPI. So that's sort of a well-known statistical sort of setup that you sort of want to represent the cost of new goods. So you include the full price of new properties as they're bought. You also include the price of rent. So both those components are in CPI, but not the cost of me buying a property from somebody else. And that, of course, sort of biases, like, the decision on whether you include that or not would bias the CPI heavily towards or away from housing, which, I mean, is quite interesting. And the fact that a greater proportion of people are renting nowadays actually has biased CPI a little bit more towards housing, and you might see that in another slide as well. Another thing that's quite interesting is that the last time the survey of household spending was done, there was no attribution of online-only retailers. So there's no loading in the CPI for online-only retailers, as I understand it. So that means all the Amazons, .coms, that spending is completely ignored. And similarly, the app economy, so buying sort of all your music and stuff on your iPhone or in an app store, won't be part of CPI. So there are some sort of big exclusions there. That said, it's also worth thinking about what is included. So for any particular problem, it's probably worth asking the question, well, do I want to include the strong increases in tobacco prices as part of my index? Is that representative of the problem I'm studying? Or how exposed am I to petrol prices or not, or university fees? So everything you can think of is actually usually in the index. And it is sometimes worth thinking, well, given that it's easy to sort of mix, slice and dice those 87 subcategories or even the 11 sort of supercategories, what is the best representation of an index for a particular problem? So that's the end of the first hypothesis, which is the longest one, I might add. So Given that, we sort of move on to RBA targeting of CPI. So one worry I had lying in bed one night is that maybe RBA inflation targeting is biased, because we'll get to it in a second, but the RBA doesn't look at raw inflation. It looks at a smooth version of inflation. So if you have lots of things going on that get ignored by the RBA considerations, then maybe the RBA is targeting the wrong thing. And the answer is that it's not that big of a problem. So there are lots of other biases in CPI that should be keeping me up at night rather than the bias in Reserve Bank targeting. So when we think about biases for inflation, one of the biggest biases is when people equate CPI for a cost of living index. And so because it's a basket of goods, CPI tends to be larger than the cost of living changes, because people will tend to substitute between categories. So that substitution bias, which to some extent is allowed for at the lowest levels, is not really allowed for in CPI, and that can be one of the most misleading things in how CPI is used. There are other problems with potential biases in CPI, so it's quite hard to develop the correct weights at the lowest levels, so figure out which brands of bread are the right weights to put them together to get your bread index. There's also a new good bias index. There's a new goods bias. So when a new product comes to market, firstly, it won't be in the CPI for at least a few years until it gets recognised. Secondly, it tends to start expensive, a new good, and then fall quite quickly in price, and that can have sort of quite perverse changes to the index. And so that actually makes it quite hard, and I mean, the ABS does its best to correct some of these things. And then there's also coverage bias, which is sort of the inclusions and exclusions that we looked at before. So those biases are quite significant, and it turns out that they're the things that you should be worrying about rather than the Reserve Bank targeting. So the Reserve Bank focuses on two sort of stabilised measures of CPI from quarter to quarter. So they look at the trimmed mean, which is they sort of arrange their subcategories from lowest, biggest decrease through to biggest increase. They chop off the bottom 15% and the top 15% and then take the mean of the remaining 70%. And they also look at the median CPI. So if you take that same arrangement of categories and just take what the middle change is. So both those things effectively remove the extreme changes. And so in theory, if you had a lot of upward extreme changes, that would create a bias. It turns out that the downward extreme changes have tended to occur more. So most studies of this thing, and again more detail in the paper, seem to suggest that the Reserve Bank measure is a little bit biased on the high side relative to raw CPI. And you can sort of see that on the picture here. So here's quarterly CPI, trimmed mean against CPI. And you can see perhaps maybe around the 2007 point, and sort of just before and after, that the trim mean sort of looks like it's a little bit higher than the raw mean on an average basis. Most of that seemed to have dissipated over the last few years, and so the two things are actually quite close to each other, which, I mean, among other things, suggests that we have a fairly benign inflation environment at the moment. So that's hypothesis two. Hypothesis three is sort of something that I find quite interesting as well, which is inflation measurement getting harder? And I think the answer is probably yes. So one of the biggest challenges with CPI measurement is the transition to services. So most of national accounting and statistics collection was designed sort of around World War II and after World War II, and it's well suited to a manufacturing or agricultural economy or mining, but less well adapted to sort of services industries and the information age. And so what we've seen then since then is a big transition to services, and this sort of creates its own challenges in how you measure CPI. So categories that are fairly easy to measure, like food and clothes and household furnishings, have decreased in their weight quite a lot. Some of them have halved. There I've got the class weights between 1982 and 2011, and the relative weight of clothes in the CPI index has halved over that time period. The things that have increased, firstly, you can see housing is much more important than it used to be, and so that's mainly new houses and rents, remember. So a lot more people are spending a greater portion of their income on those two things. But the other things that have increased are sort of the four categories on the far right. So recreation, education, communication and financial services. So most of those have some sort of service component attached to them. So they've gone from collectively from 18% to about 30%. And those things are actually harder to measure. So when you think about the cost of going to the hairdresser, well, it might have gone up a bit, but is there a quality improvement there? How long do you spend at the hairdresser? Is it time-based or is it sort of hair-based? So you've got sort of all sorts of questions, and you have to make these decisions for all the industries. So for legal industry as well, are you looking at an hourly basis or a per service basis? Do you look at the substitution to conveyancing as opposed to sort of proper lawyers? Turns out that assessing the quality of services is much harder, and assessing the sort of the relative use and how they change over time is quite hard as well. So the ABS makes their best effort, and they do a good job, but it is harder than it used to be. So there are other challenges as well. So technology has caused its own problems with statistics collection. So lots of things that people used to pay money for are now arguably free. So if you look at the price of a newspaper, well, it's gone up a lot if you look at the price of buying a physical copy of the newspaper, or it's gone down a lot if you just look at the SMH or the Age for free. The cost of a GPS app might have gone up a lot if you buy one of those dedicated devices for your car, or it might have gone down a lot if you just use Google Maps. Industry disruption, the speed at which an industry is changing makes collecting statistics very hard. So if you think of your Ubers and Airbnbs, none of those sort of price changes would be well reflected in the current index. And as I mentioned before, online-only retailers are quite fast and dynamic, but they're also excluded from the current index. In addition to that, there's been a greater rise of personalised pricing. So the idea of having rewards programs, so you get money back from retailers, that sort of undermines the idea that you pay a fixed price for something. Similarly, you might have a telco customer, a special deal, or you might have special deals on your bank interest rates, which are currently excluded, or you might have tailored pricing for your professional services. So to the extent that personalised pricing happens, it's actually very hard for a field agent to then collect what the price is of those things. So it's not all doom and gloom, of course. So there are some upsides to having technology. The ABS does get feed in, so some of their scanner technology, so they get direct feeds for some stuff. And there are sort of new indexes out there which are kind of cool. So one of the coolest ones is the MIT index, which has been running for a few years, where they actually just scrape a lot of prices from websites and the internet mainly, and sort of create their own CPI index in America. And it seems to track the official CPI quite well. And not only that, they get a daily number as opposed to a quarterly or a monthly number, which is pretty cool. So that's sort of the CPI index itself. I tacked on one more hypothesis because it has a different conclusion to the last time I thought about inflation a few years ago. So Australia has a bunch of inflation-linked bonds, and the conclusion I drew in 2009, I think it was that they're not very useful for forecasting, which was probably true then, but isn't really true anymore. And the biggest difference is the amount of issued inflation-linked bonds. So you can see sort of at the left-hand side of that chart in June 2009, there was about sort of $8 or $9 billion of face value inflation-linked bonds. So these are bonds where the coupon and final payments sort of increase with CPI. And the government ramped that up a fair bit over the subsequent 4 years. And so we now actually have quite a reasonable portion of the government's sort of bond issuance being inflation-linked bonds, and it's over $30 billion now. So one consequence of that is that the market's a lot more liquid. So I don't know how good you are at squinting at charts, but between 2004 and 2008 on the chart on the right, you can see that while the nominal bond yields are sort of rising and falling, the inflation-linked bond yields aren't doing much at all. So that's not what you'd expect from a liquid market, because inflation was fairly benign in that period, whereas now the two curves seem to be doing a better job of moving up and down together. They're not exactly the same, so the amplitude of the lower curve, inflation linked, is about 80%, which suggests that for every 1% change in yield curve, you get a 20% change in inflation expectations, which is probably about right. So inflation-linked bonds are more useful than they used to be, which is good. So I'd like to move on to AWE, and I promised Wayne that I'd be quick, and I've turned out to be less quick than I planned, so I will try and be quick. So the one big problem I have with the AWE, so average weekly earnings, is that it is an average, a mean value, rather than a median value. And so everyone from a very young age is sort of drilled into them, if they listen in math class, that the median is better to use when you've got a skewed distribution. So when you look at house prices, you always talk about median house prices. But we don't do that with earnings. And it's perhaps a problem. So the reason why we don't do that is mainly because of the way we collect this information. So the ABS collects our earnings information by surveying a bunch of companies. And so for each of 5,000 companies, they'll ask, how much are you paying on your payroll? And they'll also ask, how many people do you have employed? And they do that for a particular week or two-week period in sort of a specified month. And because of that, it's actually very easy to calculate the average wage, because you just sum up all the payments and divide by the number of people, and that's your average wage. It's very difficult to get medians from that, as you can imagine. It's also worth noting that it's not a cost, it's not a basket compared to CPI, so it does evolve with the economy, so as more people move into services or into higher paying jobs, AWE evolves with it. So there are some notable exclusions from AWE, just like we had from CPI. The biggest are probably those first two there. So there's no measurement of salaries for self-employed individuals and people who manage unincorporated businesses. So that's possibly around 2 million people whose wages aren't really included in AWE. And those wages tend to be a little bit lower than average, and they tend to be more skewed than average as well. So you do have some big self-employed individuals with big incomes. So the ABS used to have a series called Employee Earnings, which they released once a year, and that had both a median and a mean figure in it. So that's now been discontinued. But one of the interesting findings is that the mean did indeed grow faster than the median. So over the course of that series, it's gone from about 6% higher, the mean versus the median, to about 20% higher. And most of that gap has opened up since 1995, so the last 20 years or so. So that sort of plus 14%, I think, is a big deal, because it means that for anything that you've linked to AWE, whether that be pensions or workers' compensation entitlements, if you peg them to a median index instead of a mean index, your current liabilities would be 14% lower if you'd done that 20 years ago. And mainly that's due to data collection, because if you had both indices available, a lot of people, I suspect, would have chosen the median at the time, because you were taught that in high school, that you should be using the median for a skewed distribution. So it does actually sort of beg the question, a larger question, about whether we should be worrying about income inequality. So when you have the mean diverging from the median, that's suggestive that you've got some sort of underlying change in the distribution of income, and maybe that's sort of the bigger question you should be worrying about, rather than those particular two measures of central tendency. And again, sort of, it's not a huge sort of focus of the paper, but it is something I think worth thinking about a little bit. So here's a graph I shamelessly ripped off somebody else. So this is from Greenville et al., which is a report done by the Productivity Commission, or by people who worked at the Productivity Commission. And they looked at how income distribution was changing over time. So you can see the dotted line at the top is sort of back what it was in 1988-89. And so that's sort of the distribution of weekly income. And it's adjusted for CPI, so it's sort of in real terms. And the red line is the latest estimates they have, so the 2010 Household Economic Survey. And so they give sort of all these issues quite a good write-up in that paper, so they actually give income inequality a good treatment. But it does suggest that it has sort of shifted a lot, so the tail has fattened a lot, and you can sort of see why the mean has been dragged up relative to the median. Interestingly, if you're interested in mode income, so the most common income, sort of conditional on some degree of smoothing, I guess, the difference is even more stark. So that 14% gap that you see over the last 20 years becomes more of a 20% gap. So one of the things people do to measure inequality is the Gini index, and the Gini index has indeed gone up. So that's what it looks like when you look at real income for individuals. It turns out when you look at something like disposable income at a household level, the situation's not quite as serious. So the chart on the left there divides household into quintiles based on their income, and the line that's going across is the average increase of income within each of those households in real terms. And that's over the 1995 through to 2014. And you can see that yellow line's actually pretty flat. So even as incomes have sort of varied over time, so you can see those bars represent different time periods, and it hasn't always been the same. The spread is reasonably consistent, and I attribute that to a few things without having sort of thought about it long enough. So one is that we do have a very targeted welfare system, so sort of family benefits and so forth, and we also, a household is sort of a sum of individuals, and so we have sort of greater workforce participation as well over that period. So that has actually balanced out some of the inequality effects. So where inequality is more stark, I think, is actually on the wealth side, so household assets, and that's the chart there on the right. And so this is one of the things that the superstar economists like Piketty have been sort of banging on about, that income inequality is sort of part of the picture, but wealth inequality is more significant. And indeed, that seems to be the case in Australia. So wealth has grown much more rapidly for the upper quintiles there. So this doesn't have as many direct implications, but it does mean if you are dealing with customers, it might be worth keeping in mind that their incomes are more diverse than they used to be. So you have more top-end people, you have sort of a group of people in the middle, and you still have the same sort of group of lower-income people that you used to have. And that's sometimes worth thinking about. So the very last hypothesis is sort of more of a personal bugbear than anything else. So you may be aware that the ABS moved from quarterly AWE reporting to half-yearly AWE reporting, and they did that in 2012. And the main reason they did that was to make my life harder. So just to sort of illustrate the issue, suppose we did a simplified reserving exercise. So I've got some claims, they're tied to AWE in some sense, so maybe they're workers' compensation claim that are pegged to AWE. I'm doing it at June 2016. The most recent income data I've got relates to February 2016. So I use that data and I inflate it up to 30 June based on my best guess, which is here a historical average. And then I set my reserve. Because I'm a thorough actuary, once the new numbers come out for the August 2016 salaries, where they come out in August but relate to May 2016 salaries, I decide to update my reserve, and the only thing I do is I replace my sort of assumed scaling up by the actual scaling up. So I get a surprise. So that surprises the difference between the actual AW increase between that 6 month period and what I'd guessed, which was here just a historical average to keep things simple. 6-7 minutes. All right. Yep. So the wage surprises have gone up a lot, so the variance is roughly doubled. So that's the chart showing there, which, I mean, is a problem. So if you're telling clients that you've got a sort of plus or minus 2% margin of error just due to the index choice itself, that is a bit of a problem. There are lots of solutions. One is just to assume 4% in the history rather than sort of use an AWE index. Or you could use something sort of a heavy-handed smoothing. So that's one thing I test here. So if you sort of create your own AWE index, which is sort of a smooth version that uses lagged values, you do actually get something where the surprises are reduced, which is sort of obscuring the issue rather than solving the issue, but at least you're doing that in a way that's less embarrassing. So that's the end. So thank you very much for bearing with me. So 7 conclusions there for 7 hypotheses. Hopefully you've learned something.
We've got a bell, so we're going to have to move. Does anyone have any questions for you, please? If you could please go up to the microphone. It's a pretty good summary. Oh, looks like Greg. Yeah. Thanks, Greg.
Hugh, in one of the early slides where you were displaying the inflation movements of components of the CPI, there was a puzzling feature in that Some of them showed a distinct seasonal sawtooth. Pharmaceutical was the marked one, and there was another which may have been hospital. Do you have any idea why they exist?
No, I haven't looked at that in a lot of detail. I presume hospital sort of is perhaps tied to the private health system. So they sort of, I mean, there's clear seasonal patterns in the way that those things are priced. Maybe the pharmaceuticals have a PBS-related increase, but I don't know, sorry. Mm.
Thanks, Hugh. Just one quick question. I don't know if you've given any thought or aware of any research into maybe more taking inflation to the future, certainly with discount rates. There's obviously a term structure of discount rates. Mm. I think when we do reserving, we kind of often, we might do fancy stuff to de-index the history, but the future's always just 4% or the mean. Do you think there's value in a term structure of future inflation?
Yeah, so I could have talked a long time about that because I find it fascinating. So one thing is that if you have useful inflation-linked bonds, you can use that to estimate future inflation. So that's CPI rather than AWE. But that is inherently a market signal about what expectations are. So it's not quite that easy because you have to allow for a liquidity premium if you believe it exists. And also that term structure, so whether there is a price on, I guess, protecting against inflation risk. And then there's sort of two lines of approach. One is that you could argue that you need to figure out what that premium is for protecting against inflation risk and subtract that off what the inflation expectations you're getting from there. And so there are various estimates on that. At the moment, it looks like that premium is actually pretty close to zero. Or you could argue that we've been doing it wrong the whole time. And so we sort of tend to take what we think of as a central estimate of inflation. But if we have a market signal here, even if it's got some sort of premium built in, well, that we should be consistent with the market. So perhaps we should be using that, including the premium, which I think would be a departure from main practice. But I mean, certainly some colleagues have been arguing about this quite recently, which would be fun, I think.
Thanks. Any other questions before we wrap up? I think that was an excellent question, Sean. I'm one of those colleagues. interestingly, if you want to look it up, the Cleveland Fed has a term structure of price inflation for the US market. So there's certainly work done in that area, but there seems like there's a long way to go. Okay, well, I'll wrap things up before we need to move to our next session. Hugh, a really useful investigation and summary of something that we all use all the time, and I dare say we know a bit more about that than we did before today's session. I really encourage people to read Hugh's paper. It includes this gem. Microsoft Office pricing will vary upon a new release, but it is difficult to measure how much of any price increase is due to quality. that's a highlight, I think you'll agree. I'd like to put in a request for you to perhaps have another look at the inflation-linked bonds and inflation structures and things like that to update that work from previously. I think there's a lot to be gained. And one final suggestion for another paper, for next time perhaps, ABS budget cuts, a cost-benefit analysis. Everybody, please thank Hugh Miller for his presentation.